This week, Frank Wang from Cybersecurity Factory joins us. We've got some listener feedback from Philip on firewalls as functions. In the startup news for this week, what do I do now? I ask myself that question a lot, actually. The ultimate PowerPoint slides to save hours on your next pitch or deck. That's one I'm very interested in this week, and I'll explain why. HP has Christian Slater going full Mr. Robot, which is just, it's interesting. I want to hire Christian Slater to test my network. Be awesome. Startup news and notes include Yahoo. Their CEO wants to give her bonus back. Falconry and, of course, Palo Alto Networks' acquisition of Light Cyber. I deem that as Palo Alto went on a light diet, which I think is pretty funny, although not everyone does. So all that and more on this edition of Startup Security Weekly. This is a Security Weekly production. Brought to you by LogRhythm's NetMon Freemium delivers real-time network visibility to quickly identify emerging threats in your IT environment. NetMon Freemium is a free commercial-grade network forensics and traffic analytics solution. You can use NetMon Freemium's powerful capabilities to search against all observed network traffic, identify abnormal traffic patterns and application usage, and quickly analyze full packet captures. Take the first step towards real-time network visibility. Visit logrhythm.com/freemium to learn more and download it today. Gain control of cyber risk with Tenable.io, the first vulnerability management platform built for today's elastic assets like cloud, containers, and web apps. Discover a fresh, asset-based approach that prioritizes vulnerabilities while seamlessly integrating into your environment. And improve ROI with the first elastic licensing approach based on assets, not IP addresses. Tenable.io delivers the data and context you need to secure your elastic attack surface. Start your free Tenable.io trial today by visiting Tenable.io.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Startup Security Weekly. I'm your host, Paul Asadorian. It is, in fact, is it March 3rd? I didn't put this in my notes.
3-3.
It is 3-3-17 in the house. Mr. Michael Santarcangelo is on the lines via Skype from the beach. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
We're, of course, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, where it feels like winter today.
You know, I gotta tell you what, if we've had a week of 80 degrees and I opened up the door this morning and went, well, it feels more like 40. So I felt for a brief moment like I may have been in G Unit Studios. promptly retreated back because it feels safer that way.
There you go. Before we introduce our guest for today's show, a couple of quick announcements. The 10th anniversary edition of Source Boston is going to be held this April, including training sessions on April 24th through the 25th. And conference talks on the 26th and the 27th, featuring awesome speakers from the security community. Events will take place in Boston at the Courtyard Marriott downtown, and Security Weekly listeners get a $100 discount on either the training or conference passes, when they use the code SecurityWeekly. Visit sourceconference.com for more information. And InfoSec World is happening in 2017, in April as well, on the 3rd through the 5th at the Omni Orlando Resort Champions Gate in Orlando, Florida. Michael Santarcangelo and myself will both be there doing stuff like presenting and workshops and stuff. If you're a Security Weekly listener, you get 10% off the Conference or World Pass using the code OS17-SW. You can hear talks and workshops from Michael or myself or some other characters like that character Kevin Johnson and that character, Rich Mogul. And then there's Cory Doctorow, who's probably smarter than all of us put together, and then some. So you should go to this conference to hear all those people speak as well. You can find out more at infosecworld.misty.com. That's going to be fun, Michael. It's getting closer, too. It's about a month away.
Well, and I'll tell you what. I was just talking with KT, who was on Security Weekly with us a couple weeks ago, this week, about the leadership summit. So right before the conference on April 2nd, is the Leadership Summit. That's my main responsibility. We're doing a panel, and I'm actually doing some private coaching while we're there that KT is making available to different people. So if you're interested in that, reach out to her.
I want private coaching from you, Michael.
You got it. I will make sure you get private coaching. You're on the list, pal.
It has to be at a place that serves alcohol, though. That's my only requirement.
I think that's probably some good – I mean, you want straight talk. If you have too much, you get slurred talk. But right up to that, inhibition's gone. It's going to go right. But I'll tell you what, we're looking at – what's neat about this, and KT has really been great to work with on this. We put together something that's not just hey, we're getting a bunch of CISOs together, we're going to talk. We've got some exercises. We're going to talk about entrepreneurship. We're going to talk about startup mindset and mentality, but we're going to do some exercises. And the idea is that it's going to help you lead and communicate better, even if you're not a startup, in your job today. And so I'm really excited about that. So I'm actually going to be in Orlando on Saturday, and then I'll be there all the way through the closing bell. And I think you and I are going to try to get together with David Conrad while we're there too, right? And
I was doing some exercises in prep.
Getting ready?
In prep for your leadership summit.
There you go. Sorry. You're getting stretched out. I love it. Yeah. That's perfect.
I'm ready now.
So no, it's exciting. It's going to be fun. And we're going to be together, and we're going to get a chance to meet people. So if you're going to be there, look us up.
It's always trouble. There's a reason why I think Michael and I do this from different locations and only see each other at specific conferences, because we get in trouble. John Strand's the same way. God forbid the three of us got together.
I was going to say, that's everybody will know about it. At least the arrest records will be clear. So.
That's right. Yeah. Everyone's like, what happened to all the whiskey? I'm like, John was here. No other. So why don't you introduce our special guest for today?
Yeah. So if Frank Wang is joining us today, and this is great. If you guys remember, and this is, I don't know, a couple months ago, I tweeted out something about the Cybersecurity Factory, and I was like, man, this looks interesting. So Frank responds. He's like, cool, what do you want to know? And it's like, okay, we got to talk. So we've talked to Frank a couple times, and he's agreed to come on the show. Frank's got an impressive background. He's doing a PhD in applied cryptography. He's been around the industry a lot. He's doing startup stuff. He's working with venture capitalists. I mean, this is what I wish I was able to do back when I was in college. So Frank, soon, maybe one day, Dr. Frank, welcome to the program. We're excited you're here. And man, have we got some questions for you.
Thanks, Michael. I think you probably give me more credit than I deserve, but that's fine. I'll take it. So.
Well, so let's start. So your undergraduate was applied crypto, and now you're focusing on building secure systems. So what does that mean? You're getting a PhD. What are you focusing on?
Yeah. So I think usually when kind of I advertise it, it's about building kind of practical secure systems. So the idea is that we have a lot of these like systems that have a lot of data. There's a lot of users. So how do we actually integrate security in a way that's non-intrusive? And what I'm specifically doing for my PhD is we now know that systems get hacked, things get leaked, data gets leaked. So how do we kind of like harden these systems so that even when hacks happen, we actually leak the least amount of information? And so the way we do this most commonly, or what's industry accepted, is to use cryptography. But the problem is cryptography is like wildly inefficient just out of the box, because a lot of it's very mathematical, it's theoretical. And so the question is, how do we actually build practical systems that use cryptography more efficiently?
I got to think, timing-wise, this is great. I mean, if you look at the kerfluffle, if we use that word between...
Wow.
Do you like kerfluffle?
Oh, my God, hold on to my seats for this interview.
I'm talking to smart people, Paul. I'm trying to sound smart myself, all right? It's not often we get somebody as smart as Frank. Maybe everybody's smarter than us, and I just need to use bigger words. But if you look at what happened with Apple and the FBI, I mean, have you found in your work that's put a bigger spotlight then on crypto? And it sounds like you're driving towards a little bit of usability, because I would say crypto's great, except for, man, if you tried using it, and that's for 20 years we've struggled with that. So do you feel more pressure? Do you feel more excitement? Or no, Michael, this has always been going on, and it's not that exciting.
I mean, we've always been thinking about this for a while, but I think the awesome thing is that other people are excited about it, not just me. So I think there's a lot more excitement. There's a lot more like people being interested in what I'm doing, right? This me telling people and people saying, yeah, like that's cool. I guess like that's a nerd thing to say, but you know, like, who cares, right? But I think now people have started to care. I think people in the community, people who don't do security, now say like, hey, yeah, like, cryptography is important. People can come and subpoena me. And now if I'm a company like Apple and I use cryptography, well, then I can just say like, I don't have the key. The user has the key. So, you know, you can harass me as much as you want, but I actually don't have access to this data. I think people are like warming up to the fact that that's like an awesome thing to say, like reduces liability. Companies worry a lot less. And then they worry a lot less about even like when people are like snooping on their system. So I think that aspect is awesome.
Yeah, you know, we see that a lot because we on this program, naturally, we talk a lot about cloud and we talk about cloud services and SaaS and that type of stuff. And if you and we've all been doing this long enough that if you go back even a couple years and you'd say like, well, are you encrypting the data? They'd be like, no. And, or they'd say, yeah. You say, cool. Well, can I control the key? No. Now, almost everything is like, yep, you have the key. You control it. I don't see it. I don't need it. I don't need to be part of it. So I think that's a trend that we're heading toward. So that by itself is interesting, but we're here to talk about startups. And so what I'm curious then is, not only are you doing that, you're a member of Rough Draft Ventures, and you guys run this cybersecurity factory. So although I'm partly interested in how does that happen, tell us about what Rough Draft Ventures is.
Yeah, so Rough Draft Ventures is a student-run initiative run by a large venture firm called General Catalyst. They're in deals like Airbnb and Snapchat. And so their idea is that they want to get in on companies started by students very early, kind of like when they have their very initial product, before they even have users or maybe a few users. And the idea is that we want to be kind of the first venture support mechanism. We want to be the first check that's cut. And we want to be the first resources that they use to kind of like bootstrap their company and get it off the ground. And so it's just a group of students who are very excited about startups. We get together, find student startups that need some extra support, and try to find the best way to support them.
But it's interesting then. So as a student, it's not so much that you have a startup and you're using this to get funding. It's that you're a student who's helping other students with startup ideas do better and get connected to the world of funding. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think the problem with like most students is that when you're kind of like in like a university like MIT or Harvard, a lot of times you kind of get caught up with classes, you kind of get caught up with like your activities. If you want to do a startup, a lot of it's about relationships, networks, getting involved in the industry. And so kind of like, how do you branch out outside of kind of your school bubble and kind of like go out and just like find more users outside of your school, kind of connect to the right people in industry with experience that can help you out. And kind of like, those are the things we're trying to help with Rough Draft Ventures.
So you're kind of like Ehrlich on Silicon Valley. You're like, yeah, come like hang out at my house. Like, I'll only take like 5 or 10% of your company, and we'll totally like help each other.
I mean, I guess so. You can look at it like that. But I mean, we don't take 5 to 10%, but right. Wow, we do good. Like kind of like hang out with these founders, and we try to make these connections. I think I guess his company turned out pretty well in Silicon Valley. So, you know, we're trying to do the same.
So from a General Catalyst perspective, you know, one of the things we've looked at too is people tend to be good investing at what they're good at. So you've got angel investors, you've got people that like the risk of the seed rounds. But then when you get to Series A, Series B, and beyond, there's a different discipline that goes to it. It almost sounds like this has created a way to filter out opportunities, get in early with limited money, but it almost sounds too like it's not taking up a lot of the resources and the attention of General Catalyst. They've actually said, hey, you know who's in a good position to do this? Other students. Let's let them take a look at it. And then if things go on, so if somebody works with Rough Draft Ventures, does that create a potential pathway to them for General Catalyst? And is that selling point for everybody in the process? Or is this really much more just disconnected? Somebody wanted to do something and give back.
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of both. I think when Peter Boyce started this 3 or 4 years ago, his idea was that there are just not enough resources on campuses to help startups. I think that was a very simple premise. Like, student founders don't have enough resources. They don't have kind of like the capital to even just buy a laptop, right? And so His idea was like, we just need to give a little bit of capital, create a community around students who can help each other, and kind of like a place where kind of like students can just share advice and kind of have connected resources. I think that was kind of the very initial premise. And I mean, I think it would be dishonest to say that, you know, there are no companies that from Rough Draft that have gone General Catalyst funding. I think one out of every eight companies that gets Rough Draft funding ends up getting some form of General Catalyst money.
That's a pretty good percentage. Yeah, that's
a pretty good percentage. I think like when it comes down to it, I think General Catalyst wants to develop relationships with founders very early in their career. And I think a lot of venture firms kind of are very focused on that and like kind of developing relationships with early stage founders or founders very early on in their career. Because, you know, if this startup doesn't work out, they're probably going to end up doing something else more awesome. And kind of like being able to create that relationship early is like extremely important.
So Rough Draft Ventures, and because we're going to talk about Cybersecurity Factory, but Rough Draft Ventures is not cybersecurity focused, right? You're basically on, and it's not, or you're not just on MIT. So do you support other colleges in Boston?
Yeah. So we support any kind of, any university. So we have just the basic kind of like high level, requirement that you have to feel like a student team. You have to have like mostly student founders. We're actually out in New York and in Boston, and we support kind of mostly universities out of those two large metropolitan areas.
Okay. So then tell us about Cybersecurity Factory.
Yeah. So Cybersecurity Factory is just a summer program I run with Highland Capital. It's a 10-week program. We give them a little bit of capital for the summer to kind of get started. And I think our main claim to fame is our very dedicated mentorship. So we assign you a group of security executives that work with you for all 10 weeks. So it's not like one of those mentorship programs where you see the mentor once or they come and give a talk and then they just see you one time and there's disjoint advice. You get a team of, I think, 7 to 8 mentors who are kind of like the CTOs or CEOs of big companies like Rapid7, Veracode, Akamai. And so they come and they mentor the teams for the 10 weeks and kind of give them advice and help them find product market fit or whatever kind of problems early stage security companies are facing at any given point in time.
Are you the one who started it? Because that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I started it. I had this idea and I approached Highland. I was having, the way it started was I was actually having a conversation with my friend who's now a CMU professor, but she was an MIT PhD student at the time on why kind of startups don't start out of universities, especially PhD students don't start security startups. I said, well, they don't have the network, they don't have the capital. And she said, like, if we can solve that barrier, do you think, you know, more people would be interested in starting startups? And I said, sure. And then I was already had a Highland had reached out to kind of just talk to me about my PhD, and I kind of like floated the idea by them, and kind of like in that conversation, the partner there, Sean Dalton, said, hey, that sounds awesome. I'm in, like, give me a week and we can get it set up.
So you're a natural sales guy.
I wouldn't say that. I would say like sales is definitely not up my alley before this. So
I would tell you sales is definitely up your alley based on what I know and what I was listening. I know, Paul, I stepped on a question you had.
Yeah. I was just going to ask Frank, how closely do you work with these students who are creating startups? And could you identify like some of the things that they do wrong or their perception of things that's incorrect that you're helping them correct, like right out of the gate?
Yeah. So I think for Cybersecurity Factory, it's not just focused on students. We actually see a lot of first time entrepreneurs in security, and I'm kind of like, they suffer the same problems as students. And so I think one of the areas I see a problem is they're very focused on actually like doing something. So a lot of them are engineers, or a lot of them are just people who recently graduated, and they're very interested in building products and solutions, but they don't spend enough time talking to customers. And so I think that's a major issue. It's they build a solution, but there's no need for the solution. So I think they usually tell them you should spend more time talking to customers. And, you know, if they want a software solution that does X, Y, and Z, don't build like a hardware solution that does ABC is usually what I tell them.
Yeah, that's some sound advice. We see that a lot here on this show as well, and have talked about that topic a lot. My other question was, in having like the CEO of Rapid7 and others in the industry help them, and others from Veracode, have you seen the progression where you're helping an early stage startup You've helped them mold their idea so that they're actually solving customer problems, which is great. And then they want to go get some funding. Have, like, they formed a relationship with those from Veracode and Rapid7 who understand who the players are in the funding world and hooked people up with funding. I can see that as a great progression through your program.
Yeah, so I think there are kind of multiple avenues for funding. I think our program is kind of almost one of a kind. So a lot of venture firms kind of have their eye on us. And I like do a lot of the connections from the venture side. I think also, yeah, a lot of the companies that go through our program, they have these mentors. And actually, these mentors do due diligence for a lot of these venture firms. So they're saying, hey, like, you know, let's bypass the due diligence process, or like, let's make this due diligence easier. Let me do a warm introduction to a venture firm for you that either funded us or that I do due diligence for, and they call me anyways, and kind of just like save them some time on that. I think as our program matures, we'll kind of like see that more and more in the future.
Oh, that's great. What's your resounding success story from a startup that's gone through your program and turned into the makings of a very successful security company?
Yeah, so I think I have like two examples. So we had a company come in about 2 summers ago, our very first summer. They just had an idea. It was not clear there's a market, and they didn't have a product. They kind of had no experience in the security community other being just PhD students from MIT. And so they kind of like went off, talked to maybe I'd say 50 customers. They talked to a bunch of venture people, and at the end of the day, now they're partnering with Intel Capital and Intel to kind of like take their encrypted data platform to the next level. I think that's like very exciting.
That's awesome.
And last summer, we actually had a company that was trying to do detect phishing attacks using computer vision. And so they came in and they had this idea of what the market was like, and they had a couple of customers, but they were small time customers. And they came in, they talked to a bunch of our mentors. Our mentors like, you know, this is like too small time for the product you want to build. You can kind of go bigger time. And so they kind of introduced them to email providers for Fortune 50 companies and another company that does email security. They're kind of like in their pipeline to kind of like help them with their phishing attacks. And they kind of like did a 180 in terms of their customers. They ditched the old ones, got like much bigger, much better, newer customers who are like able to like help them in like a bigger market. So I think that's really awesome. I think that's what we're looking for kind of out of our companies.
That's fantastic. I love this. I started with some of the failures, but I wanted to quickly move to success stories. So that's great. Michael, sorry. I was hogging the floor there for a while.
It's no worries, man. You're allowed to do that. So let's go back to application process is still open, or you're in the process of deciding now?
So the application process is still open. We have our first deadline on Monday on the 6th. And then we're going to keep on kind of looking at teams throughout March. And I think we're looking to like make final decisions around April. So there's still like plenty of time for early stage startups to apply. And we're still actively looking for companies to kind of like join us for the summer.
So the idea then, that's kind of a curious thing, and I kind of like it. So basically you've got a deadline. So like, let's say you had 10 and you like the first four, like you're good. But what you're saying is, as it takes us time to evaluate and figure it out, we'll keep it open for 2 more weeks. And if you get something in, good to go. So somebody listening now, they don't have to grind all weekend, but if they want to be in a startup, they probably should, right?
Oh, we're not allowed to use that word grind anymore after last night. Just Michael.
I'm going to have to go watch the tape on that one.
I just had flashbacks to last night. And at one point I just stopped talking and like pressed my drink against my head. It was, yeah. Out of control. Sorry.
All right.
Didn't mean to derail the conversation, but when he said that, it triggered flashbacks for me.
I'm there for you, man.
So how, Frank, how do the startups work with each other? Like, are they very open to working with each other? And how much is like that in and of itself just to help, let alone like being hooked up with CEOs and VC firms?
Oh, yeah, I think it's great. I think initially our vision around it was that we wanted there's a lot of these like accelerators out there. There's YC, there's Techstars. Those are great accelerators. But I think the problem is, you know, the security industry looks very different than like the consumer industry. Yes. Or even like enterprise SaaS. And I think our goal is to try to get security people around and kind of share problems they faced, or kind of like someone might be more of a business person, someone might be more of a product person, minded to kind of like share ideas, kind of like share customer feedback in this environment. And we try our best kind of to find companies that are in conflicting spaces when we choose the four companies. And so, for example, last summer they kind of helped each other a lot, and it was great because there were some kind of like older veterans from the industry that had been, you know, worked in the industry for 20 years as security engineers, helping kind of like the people who just recently graduated from Georgia Tech. And they were saying like, hey, like this is how you go into like a presentation, like this is what you should put in your PowerPoint. And these students were like, oh wow, like, you know, I didn't learn this in school. And the students were kind of like, showing their enthusiasm and kind of sending kind of a lot of the energy back to kind of a more jaded, like an industry veteran. So that's awesome. So we do see a lot of them kind of working together. They get coffee with each other. I try to keep it organic. I don't try to force anyone upon each other. But I think like they kind of share a lot of notes. They kind of like say like, hey, I met this customer, was a bad fit for me, but would be a great fit for you. Nice. You should definitely like reach out for them. And so I think the point of it is like, we want to build a community around it because we think there's plenty of market. There's plenty of people. Like, why not help each other? And we're trying to create that dedicated space.
Do you provide resources to these startups in terms of like even recommendations for like, you know, hey, development methodologies or business process or communication? Is there any like formal structure around that, or is it more just like a community thing, as you said earlier?
Yeah, so it's more a community. I think like the resources we provide just in general is we take like a very venture approach because we're essentially venture run or venture backed, our program with Highland. And so our idea is like, we want to be, we want kind of like teams to run their companies, and we're there just to support them at a very high level. So, we kind of like leave a lot of their interactions with mentors up to them, and we kind of provide high level, like, but very targeted advice. Like, we probably provide, you know, a couple of levels deeper advice than like a venture firm that doesn't do any security investing. It's just general like enterprise investing, for example. And so we're able to say like, here are some markets we've looked at. Here's kind of like our thoughts around it. Here are some questions we have. Like, it would be great if you had these answers. Like, other venture firms might ask this, or customers might ask this. So we take more of an analytical approach to when we kind of spend time with companies. Like, they come to us and say like, we talked to a customer, they said X, like, what do they really mean? Can you like help me kind of like work through this and like take a step back and like think about high level, like, what does this mean for a company?
So when are you going to start working on your startup, Frank?
I don't know.
I was going to say, I mean, got a background in crypto. You understand the role. It's a hot topic. You've been working with startups and venture. How much longer till you graduate?
I have about a year. I'm looking at graduating in 2018. And so, I mean, my next step would be mostly hitting the academic professor job market. I think from there, I think you see a lot of professors doing startups. So probably the next like 2 or 3 years, you might see me like start thinking more about startup ideas. If I land at like a good university with students and kind of like work with them on kind of like ideas, I still think like, you know, universities are like a great place to initially start your startup and get it off the ground. So kind of like, that's why I'm pretty focused on getting like a professor job to kind of bridge or take a lot of the technologies in university to market. I think that's like a very big problem I see, especially in academia. It's like hard to take technologies to market. And so that's why technology, I'm like so focused.
Yeah, it's interesting. We call it technology transfer. And I'm part of a couple groups that actively look at that. I'll tell you the thing that most astonishes me. So keep this in mind as you go and try to solve that. You'll find somebody that got a grant to solve a very specific problem. They solve the problem, the grant is done, everybody's happy, the work is published, they never talk about it. And you stumble across it and you're like, whoa, we need something just like that over here, but we've never connected those dots. And I think that looking at technology transfer, especially when it comes to cyber, is a huge missed opportunity in a lot of organizations. The other thing is, because a lot of the funding is grant and it's focused on very specific problems, we don't always look at the applicability of it. So it's solved theoretically. The challenge is always how we apply it. But it sounds like, I mean, again, your startup background on that, that's fascinating. I mean, I think it's a good strategy. I also wouldn't be surprised if you've got to fend off some offers for people to come get you to just work with them sooner.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like the general problem, just like what you've described is, I think another problem is like there's this like academic and academia and industry relationships. Like, there are very few professors who kind of like put themselves out there and say like, hey, I want to connect with venture capitalists. I want to connect with kind of like the startup community to kind of like think through, like, I have an idea, like keep it in the back of my mind. Like, could this be a technology that we see in industry? Kind of like have that interaction. I think when you have those connections, like the talent is in the universities, like these students can go off and, you know, get started with like very little overhead. And I think, yeah, that's something we should definitely think about more. And I'm like trying to, you know, spend more time thinking about that.
I wouldn't be surprised, Frank, if you're back sooner than 2 or 3 years and Michael and I are talking to you about your awesome startup.
Yeah. We'll be older. We'll both be balder.
You'll we'll have be older great and balder and more curmudgeon-y and all that and, kind of stuff.
Interesting ideas. I got to tell you, though, like, you know, even listening to you now, I mean, what I'm impressed with about you and about this program is that you're saying, okay, we need ways to keep connecting all these different things together. And so even though you were very polite about downplaying your sales ability, I think it's fantastic. So if you end up going that route of being a professor, you know, keeping one eye on technology transfer, which you'll, if you haven't played with that yet, you'll love it. Or you probably won't. But then also working with the startups and working with the venture world and everything else. I mean, think about the role you'll play, even if it's not for your own startup, but just kind of shepherding all those things together. Dude, it's, remember us when you make it famous. So that's great. So people are starting to apply for the program now. I think we've solved your future issues. Let's talk briefly then, what gets you excited? So you're right, you're in a hotbed of activity. You're focusing, so you've focused on crypto, you understand the space. So what are some of the startups that are getting you fired up? Maybe they're applying to your stuff or not, but like when you look at the space, what are the things that you look for and what kind of gets you excited these days?
Yeah, so I think just generally that I think the security space is very exciting because it's a space where you don't see a major player quite yet. And I think, for example, you don't see a Google in security, you don't see a Facebook, you don't see kind of like name your big company that's like dominating that space. Like you don't see like an Amazon there. And so I think the space is like very new. And I think companies have recently just started to think about their IT needs or their IT security needs, and they really need to kind of be serious about them. And I think this really recently started where, you know, in 2014, all these big corporations got hacked that we thought were kind of indestructible or like, you know, security was an issue for them. But it turns out like everyone's vulnerable, especially large corporations. And then I think these like mid-market enterprises in kind of like the Fortune 1000 or Fortune 5000 are starting to say like, hey, we have like a lot of important customer data. We don't want to fail because people stopping like aren't buying from us anymore because they think, you know, we can't handle our data. And so I think I'm very excited about kind of just this idea of managed services and security where, you know, you have an IT team, they don't really know what they're doing, but, you know, they can kind of like interface with a company who just manages their security for them and says like, hey, you have an incident. This is how you should respond. We could come there, or if you're capable of doing it, we'll kind of walk you through it. And I think that'll put like a lot of companies at ease. And I think on top of that, just like technologies that supplement kind of like what's already there. So for example, a lot of companies have IT security people. They might not be the best security people, but with the right tools, they're able to kind of like contextualize attacks and say like, hey, like that's an incident. We know how to respond to it. This is how we respond to it now. Here, we've done in the past, so like let's not waste time kind of like chasing down something we already know. And so kind of like getting, now we have all this data, like just these data platforms that allow us to like figure out real-time attacks. I think those are very, very exciting.
You know, there's a piece that I really like because I've talked to people recently about how do we train a new worker category. How do we bring people into the field? How do we train them up? I never thought about it as like an MSSP, that you give them a certain set of tools, but that you can then take the folks that you have there and level them up. Man, first person that comes to that, they're going to run with it. That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. So I think that's kind of like a space that definitely is like very open. I think there's a lot of like market space for people, so to kind of navigate that.
I'm with you 100%. Paul, other questions?
I think I'm good. My closing question is, where can we find more information? And specifically, our listeners and viewers can find information.
Yeah, so if you want more information about me, my website is frankwang.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at FFWANG2. If you want more information about Cybersecurity Factory, the website cybersecurityfactory.com. And for Rough Draft, it's roughdraft.vc.
Frank Wang, thank you very much for appearing on Startup Security Weekly.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
With that, we're going to take a short break, come back, talk about the startup news for this week. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Access over 2,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content live and on-demand via your PC, mobile device, and more. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, visit itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested these public assets? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting@blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. A couple of quick announcements. IT Pro TV's courses now include Exchange 2016, Wireshark, ECIH, and ECES. IT Pro TV is introducing a new membership level starting on March 8th. The new standard... I'm hitting the wrong keyboard. It's pretty funny. I'm like, why is nothing happening? The new standard membership for IT Pro TV is $57 a month or $570 per year and includes access to the on-demand course library, live chat, and the Q&A forum. The new premium membership, which is $85.70 per month or $857 per year, includes access to all standard membership features, unlimited Transcender practice exams, virtual labs, and access to the enterprise portal. Downloadable courses are available with annual, standard, or premium memberships. I think I have one more announcement. Yes, the call for papers is open for B-Sides London, being held on June 7th at the ILEC Conference Center in, well, London, of course. The CFP closes on March 27th, and presenters will be announced on May 1st. They're also looking for presenters for the rookie track, mentors for the rookie track, and folks to run workshops. Find out more at securitybsides.com.uk. Michael, I think we're going to talk about just my stories this week. Is that okay?
I think it's a good idea.
Well, you know what it is, Mike? You add so many fabulous stories, and then we're covering all those other people. I'm like,
I was just giving you a hard time, dude.
The show would be like 4 hours.
I got to tell you, me doing the stories is cathartic. Like, I enjoy it. And this was a week, I got to tell you, and this is one of the things that I love. Like, you look for things that start to change or help you understand you're on the right track. This was a week where we got listener feedback. So we'll start with that in a minute. And then two of the stories actually came from a previous guest and like probably one of our biggest fans. And it's like, yes, I mean, this, because that means that we're hitting on the stuff that people want to hear about. And you know, because there's so much to cover in the world of startups. I mean, I actually started thinking about this week ways to better visualize security, not on a network. Like, what's our ecosystem look like and from whose perspective? And how do we start to calibrate that? And I started looking at it from a startup perspective, partly because I think that helps me as a business. Paul, I've got to share it with you. I've got like three iterations now, and every time it changes just a little bit. And so having people send us stuff to talk about is awesome. And the other thing I've started to do too is I spend a little more time with the stories now before I select them. So I make sure that we're doing things that I am listening to the startups that I'm working with struggle with, or that I'm listening to the enterprises that I'm working with struggle with. And I can either see the parallels between the two, or a lot of the startups want to work in enterprises, and a lot of the enterprises want to work with startups. I think anything we can do that eases that pathway is good. But let me tell you, it was fun. So Philip Comer, I'm fortunate that I've known him for years. And if you guys have to know each other, because you both like the dark liquors and cigars. And so
sounds like we need to hang out.
Yeah. And so if you guys don't know each other, I'm going to make sure you guys get together. But and I can't remember, you and I, we obviously do a lot of shows together. We have a lot of good conversations. I don't remember which show we were on, but we were talking about firewalls and if firewalls go away or not. And I made some comment about, well, yeah, but the function doesn't go away. And my point in that, to be more succinct, was there are things that we know today that we would consider to be important. They're not going to go away. except for they are. So what remains is the functionality. And that's the key, is that we have to start to translate what we know into a function so other people understand it. And Philip sent me a note. He goes, hey, I was just listening to you, and you're right. Here's what he wrote. I was trying to think about a future with no firewalls. And you said, will they go away? Probably. Will there be something similar? Very likely. Will it be called a firewall? No. He said, my first thought was the cable modem. Is it a modem at all? Not even remotely. Does it do something similar? Yeah. Should we call it a modem? No. And he said, that's one of my pet peeves. But is it still called a modem? Yeah. By the way, I'm going to add, show me the cable modem today that doesn't also have a firewall built into it, that doesn't also have a wireless router built into it, that doesn't also have – so what's interesting is I thought it was good. It was a good point. So then, of course, I wrote back. I said, hey, cool, which show was that? He's like, yeah, dude, I don't know. It was one of the shows you and Paul were talking. So I told Philip that I would throw it on one of the episodes whenever you and I last talked, and I wasn't able to make it last night, which maybe was good because, I didn't have to grind. Oh, yeah, I'm not supposed to
no.
say that anymore.
Okay. I think Philip brings up an interesting point, and I want to take the perspective from a startup if you're looking to solve this problem. Like, what's the problem we're trying to solve, as Michael always says? And I think that the home users require access to the internet. They need some kind of protection. And I think
we've learned that.
Yeah, and I think what Philip's saying, like, we need to get away from firewall, maybe get away from in all of these different labels, antivirus, anti-spam, and provide the end user with an easy way to give them assurances that someone is or multiple attackers are not trying to take advantage of them or gain unauthorized access. And I think that the companies that can solve this problem are going to be very successful, right? And how we do that, I think, remains to be seen. I've seen devices that go on the network that help protect people, and I've seen startups do that. And I've seen, all kinds of different takes, and I've seen big companies, I think it's Belkin that makes a security type device for the home. And when we look in the enterprise, I've seen like stuff that can install on your workstation and provide telemetry back to the cloud to help, not just from the end user perspective, but looking at traffic and connections. So that's an interesting take. I think the company that or companies that solve this problem are going to be really successful for the end user because the market is so large. And I truly believe that there's going to be a demand for it. And I think we've already started seeing some of that. But, as our homes get more connected, I think we're going to require those security devices. In my mind, if I make my prediction 5-10 years out, right, they're just going to be like table stakes, sort of like they are in the Fortune 5000 that Frank was talking about. Like, a lot of security technologies are just table stakes. You need these to be able to defend your network, in essence.
I think you've said it well, and that's actually why I remain optimistic. Maybe it's too because we do this, and I think it's good to be optimistic, but I think that you're right. It's table stakes, and as we add more connected devices into the home, the way that they interact with each other becomes exceptionally important, and the way that they signal to us that they work. I mean, you and I have been talking about this for the last couple of years. How is the chip updated? How is the software updated? What does that take? What's interesting, by the way, is that we throw those out as really easy. Like, oh, that's easy. Then you go talk to people that are actually trying to engineer those, and they say, well, wait a minute. What kind of bandwidth do you have? What kind of location will you be in? How often will you be online? How often is it okay for you to not be online? What happens if you come online after? Right? And you start to realize that's actually not as trivial to solve as we think it is. And so that's why I get excited about these things, because I think that we will see those types of solutions emerge. In fact, we get to the security notes of interest. There's one dealing with that very issue, and I'm actually curious your take on it. So we'll get to it as we get there. So the first story of the week.
No. Can we start? Hold on. Wait.
We'll start where you want.
Yeah, well, because I think you're the ultimate PowerPoint slide to save hours on your next pitch deck, and when less is more, certainly, even just reading the titles, you can see how those relate, but they relate to some things that I've been thinking about lately, in how you need multiple pitch decks and multiple sales decks, and they're somewhat related, but not really. I think, certainly the pitch deck is for investors and the sales deck is for customers. There's a lot of overlap there, but that, as we've stated on some of the earlier shows in our history, right, like those are very important, and you're never done with either of those, and you're always learning and changing and molding and shaping. And I've noticed, Michael, that whether it's a pitch or whether it's a sales thing, that I need like lots of different tools in my arsenal. And lately I'm like, I don't think I have all the right tools. Like, I really just want a deck that really just hones in on value, right? Because the goal of this conversation with this either investor or this customer, like, I don't want to get into the weeds and anything else but the value that I provide, and maybe a little about why we can provide more value than some of the other things you might consider to solve your problem, right? And I think having a shortened deck that's very to the point like that, maybe it's not even a deck, maybe it's just a one or two pager you go through with someone, or however you structure it, I'm feeling like that's really important in different scenarios. Now, there are times when you want to meet with people and take them through all of the details too, and I think you should have that as well. But I think there's some other things in there that I feel like I need to create. So,
well, I think you're right. So the ultimate PowerPoint thing, Carsten Speckman. Carsten's been great.
He's the man. He is like a huge. He's like one of our biggest fans of all our shows on the network.
Well, and what I love is we chat. We've chatted by Twitter. We've chatted by LinkedIn. And so he sent this to me, and he said, "Hey, you guys talk about this a lot. I think you might want to take a look at it." So here's what I like about this. If you guys go check out that link, the idea is it's the ultimate PowerPoint slide to save hours on your next pitch or deck. And if you go through this, I mean, they have spent an enormous amount of time looking at this. And so I want to tell you why I shared it, beyond the opportunity to give a shout out to Carsten and thank him for his continued support of us. But this is the thing, and it's what you were just talking about. I think it's great to look at how other people do things. I think it's great to use that, right? So if we think about communication, there's three basic components. There's the structure, there's the substance, and there's the style. Most people get wrapped up in the style. What I always like to point out is that the right structure will reveal the substance. And that's where we spend a lot of time helping people with straight talk and other things around that. Having a deck that's got all of these things already answered out, I love it because you're getting a little bit of each. You're getting some structure. You're getting to see how somebody else used it to provide and reveal substance. And you're seeing some of their style. Now, maybe the style works for you. Maybe it doesn't. You can approximate that. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. Now, I also went, I checked out the company. So I wanted to be a little careful. And I didn't want to just suggest something I didn't think was great. And it basically said, look, you know, it's. I think this is a good lead gen consideration. So the company's called UExec. And it basically says, look, I'm putting together all this stuff. I'm going to give it away for free. By the way, you know, if you want to get on the list and you want to know about, you know what, I added free. I'm interpreting it as free. I don't know if it's free. They might charge for it. But what they basically said was, look, if you want to get on the list, write yes below or connect with me here or do this or this. We'll pay attention to it. Boom, you can have it. So it's kind of like it's like a really clever way to do social proof. I'm looking at it. It's got 41,000 likes. It's got 78,000 comments. It's got 9,500 shares. And I went to the website. And if you go to uexec.com, it basically says, look, we want you to be better. Like, that's what we do. Weekly insights to improve your career, to be great at what you do. All right. I dig it. I like it. I like that approach. So I like this for a lot of reasons. I think it gives you some structure. I think it gives you some ideas. I think it shows you some style and some stuff that you can do, and that should save you some time. I'm actually about to rebuild my website, and I am scouring for websites that approximate what I think I'd like to do. In terms of what's the hero image look like, I'm going to do something called an upside down website. And I've reached out to a couple advisors and said, okay, what are the resources? What do I need to think about here? I'm trying to streamline. What do we need to do? So if you could do that with a PowerPoint deck, I think it's a great idea. And so I like that a lot. And that made sense to me. And Carsten, thank you for being so enthusiastic and for doing what you do, and look forward at some point to being able to meet you. So you want to talk about less is more, Paul?
Yeah. Let's do that.
You know what? Let me make a comment, though, too, because you something else I want to amplify. Yep, you need to have multiple decks. It's interesting because I've come to that realization myself. I'm going to say there's another piece because you said this. I'm just going to say it slightly differently. It's okay to walk people through the process. You don't need to give them everything all at once. That's probably going to be our setup for less is more. But, you know, what I've learned is as I'm talking to somebody, for example, right? And I think I've said this before, but it's fascinating how it took me 10 years to figure this out. Somebody that you know that's in your database or your contact manager or whatever you want to call it, they're either a contact or they're a lead. And the difference between the two is a lead is somebody you don't know anything about. There's nothing, there's no shame in it. You don't know them. They're a contact when they're qualified. What makes them qualified? That you know them. You know what, you know who they are, you know what they do, maybe you've had a conversation, you have a sense of where they're focusing on, and the problems that they're trying to solve. A prospect is somebody that has the problem that you solve in a way that can add value to it, and an opportunity is when a prospect is ready to change. They know that their status quo is not acceptable. When you start to realize that, you also realize then you need a different deck for each stage based on where somebody's at. Or to your point, maybe you don't need a deck at all. But then what I've realized is if I'm talking to an enterprise versus a startup, now this is the neat part. The structure is the same. The substance is different. And actually the style changes a little bit. Yep. From
Yeah, your audience, I mean, they could be in different stages, but also part of that matrix is they're at different levels. There's the more management focus folks, right? Business focus folks, and then there's the more technical focus folks in our industry, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying for all startups, but the more technical, you know, I think you still want to, from Carson's article he recommended, you still want to have those visuals. Like I was talking about last week, how John had that great visual on how what we're collecting and how we're measuring it and what goals those allow us to achieve. It's great for the more technical. Or if someone asks about, hey, like, how does your stuff work? Great to have that, you know? But then if you're going to a different audience, like, maybe you don't use that slide at all, right? Maybe that slide is just covered as a point on a previous slide about how you collect this different data, and through that you're able to achieve that goal, right? You don't have to dig into the weeds.
And keep in mind,
your audience is different. And again, it could be where you feel you are in the stages. And I love your four stages. I've always probably just done contact and lead, but I like the other, what was the other one? It was lead to prospect and prospect to opportunity.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. And so the way I look at it is lead is I don't know anything about them. Mm-hmm. Contact is I know about them. Prospect is they have the problem I solve. And maybe they're evaluating it, maybe not. That's the key.
Right.
So the prospect isn't necessarily looking for a thing, but they're in that situation and they probably know that they're in that situation. They're an opportunity when they have the problem that you solve and they're looking, they're evaluating, they want to solve it, or at least they're exploring if they can solve it. Now, what I've also done is I split prospect into prospect, partner, and promoter. There are some people that have or understand the problem, but frankly, they're not a decision maker, or they're not the person who's necessarily going to help with it, but they might help me in the organization. They might help me with other organizations. They believe in what we're doing, and they're making introductions, and they're helping people, and they're invaluable. And if you're watching, you're invaluable. I love you. Thank you. There's also partners, and there's people that say, hey, I like the problem you solve. How do we work together on it? And I actually have two stages now. I've been learning a lot. Not today, but someday when I'm recovered, I'm going to bitch about CRM systems. Now I'm starting to appreciate the engineering that it takes, but I'll tell you what, you want to see what it's like. If you're in security and you want to see what it's like for the people who aren't in security to interact with us, go evaluate like 5 or 6 small business CRM systems. And if you don't lose your sanity in the process, you now have a glimpse of what it's like dealing with security people if you don't understand the security the same way that they do. That aside, what I look at now is that if you want to partner with me, there's actually there's a series of steps that we work through to our mutual benefit. But I'll also still track, you know, who are the people that are good for partnering with. That made a lot of difference for me, and it really helps me start to take a look at it, because, you know, if your addressable market, we talk about this all the time, you know, with the Shark Tank reference, if your addressable market is everybody, well, that's nuts. I mean, even today, if you say my addressable market is the Fortune 5000, that's huge. So you got, you know, well, it's the Fortune 500. No, stop. Who, you know, like, we've got to get better at figuring out our addressable markets. And I'll use this as a segue, because less is more. We've talked about this with so many people that have come on our program already, and it's fascinating because this also works in the enterprise. So if you're listening to this, this applies to just about everything in life. The more narrow your focus, the better you can get at it, the faster you can move. the more you learn, you can always add. You can always add other stuff to it, other disciplines, other services, other stuff. It's all good. So when less is more. So what's interesting is when you dig into this is, and of course it brings up Silicon Valley. So we've had a double mention and we've done Shark Tank. It's a complete episode.
It's a complete episode now.
But here's the thing. The guy says, you know what? I probably should have asked for less money. The reason this is really interesting to me is if we start looking at stages of companies, right? You get your seed round, then you go get your A round. And I'm starting to notice there's an interesting thing that happens. If you're in the security community, but you're not really part of the startup community, you're like, oh man, they made it. And if you go talk to the founders, like, you get your A round, how you feeling? They're like, I am going to lose it. And you're like, wait, you just raised, you know, $5, 8, 10, 12, $15 million. They're like, do you know what I have to do now?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because when you start looking at it, your culture just changed. The size of your team just changed. Your engineering went from MVP, proof of concept, get traction to, okay, time to really operationalize what you're doing.
Sell it at scale, right? I like this sentence. It says, the best move for many startups is to raise just enough money to achieve key milestones. And I feel like that has parallels back to the sales process, right? You want to present just enough in your sales process to achieve the milestone wherever you're at in your sales process.
That's exactly right.
And I think there's a lot of parallels there.
You got it. If you try to do too much in a sales call, like, hi, I've just met you and I've got this really big sale and I'd like you to say yes at the end of the 20 minutes, you're like, what? Like, that might take a couple calls in a couple weeks or a couple months. By the way, if you're at the point in your sales cycle where you're beyond like 3 to 6 months, you need to reevaluate your sales cycle. I know our industry says, oh, it could take 12 to 18 months. That's too much friction and that's not good for anybody. But to your point, yeah, if you think that you're going to measure your success based on the size of your round, just know the bigger the round. In fact, I put a note in our notes. I learned a long time ago with comedy, short jokes are better. Why? They don't have to be as funny and you're on to the next one. If you want to do a big windup, no, you go talk to the people that do their comedy specials on HBO and stuff. They say, look, the bigger the setup, you're requiring a bigger punchline. So the corollary is if you can't deliver that big punchline, scrap the joke or go with something simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And once you know that and you start watching comedy sets, or if you've watched the stuff on Netflix or other places about how Jerry Seinfeld builds up his bits, or you look at how Chris Rock builds up his bits and all the, I won't say grind, but all the work that they go through to get that built out, there's a lot to it. And what they've learned is same thing, cognitive load, cognitive drag. You've got to stay sharp and tight and simple and then go. It's the same thing applies here. The same thing applies in sales. The same thing applies in just about everything. And we seem to think like, well, but I've got one shot. You've got one shot. If you make a big raise, then your sell at scale is bigger. And by the way, that's harder. And so I thought it was worth putting out there. Plus, you know, it had Silicon Valley. So
there you go.
I thought that was kind of cool.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
Thank you. I'm going to flip back. So Tyler Shields, a great guest on our program, he tweeted this out and I picked it up. It's called What Do I Do Now? The Startup Lifecycle. And the idea is you search, you build, you grow. And I tell you what, I loved it because as I'm reading it, when you're searching, you're doing discovery and you're doing validation. And so you're talking to customers, right? And that's one of the things Frank just talked about. You're talking to customers. You're seeing if your idea is going to float and you're figuring out how to tweak it. And I've been pretty candid on this program that I went from, hey, I've got this thing called Straight Talk. Let me tell you about all the features, which I know it was stupid, but I fell into the trap too. And then you say, okay, well, I can teach it to you. And then you say, okay, you know what? This is actually about helping teams. And now I get security projects unstuck. And I can show people. I had a great session today. You know the session where like it clicks and you watch people get it? That was today. Like today is a good day because I was working with a team and they got down to the brass tacks. We had Straight Talk and it was awesome. Cool. By the way, I'm pivoting. I've sent out some decks to people in the last 2 or 3 weeks and they get back to me a week later and I'm like, oh, my bad. I've scrapped that. That's done. I've already learned because I'm talking to enough people and getting that done. When you get here, and it says, right, by the way, most startups die here, right? Startups in search mode have little process and lots of do what it takes. Company size is typically less than 40 people, and it may have been funded with a seed round and or Series A. Yep. Yep. Especially if you're scaling. Like if you've got more than 10 people, you're going to start to figure it out. Then And so let's pick this up. So now what happens, and or Series A, yeah, not so much. Typically, by the time you get your Series A, now it's time to go build. The world just changed for you. Now you've got to be dialed in on it. So, and it's as you already said, how do I sell at scale? How do I build the company and sell at scale? By the way, how do I do both? And I've got a new board and I've got a new management team. And one of the things that you start realizing is, and they all have different experiences and they come from different places. Now that's awesome. But when I look at this in terms of straight talk, that's the leading cause for how we get stuck, because we have different experiences and different approaches and different maturities and different backgrounds. And that creates friction because we're not sure how to reconcile them. And we certainly can't reconcile them at speed. I mean, well, actually, I can. But that's something that we're not taught. You know, Frank made a comment about there's a lot of stuff you do as a startup, and you're like, well, I didn't learn that in school. Yeah, that's not a knock on anything. In fact, I think what I've learned talking and working with customers in the last couple of weeks is the way that we do work today, none of us were trained how to do this. Think about, Paul, tell me about your group projects in high school and college. You loved them, right? You were like, every time there's a group, I can't wait to be on it.
Oh, I dreaded that moment. Whenever the teacher stands up and is like, so for this next project, we're going to split up into groups. And you're like, oh, damn.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the future of our success today? Whether you're a startup or you're in an enterprise today, it's all group work. All of it.
But, you know, it's somewhat unfair, I think, especially at a college level, Michael, to speak to what you were speaking about, is maybe this was just my program, but I feel like in a lot of programs, when they do exercises like that, there's no training about leadership, right, and how to enable other people in the group to participate.
Yeah, it's Lord of the Flies.
Right? Like, yeah, they're just like, oh, yeah, just like split up into groups, but there's no guide about team interaction and how to enable people to achieve goals and motivate people. There's none of that.
I don't put a lot of the feeds up, but do you follow the Harvard Business Review blog stuff?
Sometimes.
There's going to be a story a day on that. I'm probably being facetious. There's maybe at least a story a week. That's because we don't know. And so I'm not knocking anybody or anything, but when people say to me, oh, you did that straight talk stuff because it was opportunistic. Hell no. I got into this purely because I just kept asking questions and I couldn't find answers. And I wanted to do something that was reproducible that I could explain so I understood why it did or didn't work. Paul, we don't teach people that. You know why? Because we don't really know. Because we've never sat down and said, do we have friction in our communication? Yep, turns out we do. So to bring it back to this, what I think is interesting is that so now when you're in that build phase of a startup, and I'm going to say same thing if you're a security team. I talk to enterprises where they've got security teams of 200 or 300 people. Congratulations, you are definitely in the build phase, or maybe you're in the higher phases and you're actually, you know, growing and making it work and being part of the business. There's so many parallels here into figuring out how it all works out, and it's really, really tough. And so one of the things we're going to start looking at now, Paul,
is Christian Slater.
I think we should look at Christian Slater right after I make this point. We're switching. Is that it's going to be interesting now to see where we can assess a company is when we look at their funding round. So because at this point said, look, venture-backed startups often have a Series C or Series D later rounds during their build phase. That makes sense now. I hadn't connected the two together. But like we've talked about, like, and it goes back to our last point. What's your strategy? Why do you need those people? How are they going to help you solve that problem? Or what do you need? So why are you going for that later round? There's a prediction of dilution. Cool. So what are you getting out of that? So I'm going to try to bring some more of this into our analysis as we do things. But Tyler didn't necessarily send it, but I enjoyed his interview so much. I follow the stuff he does, and I picked this up off of him. Let's talk about – so you're a fan of Mr. Robot, right?
I am. I don't know. The most recent seasons kind of got lost a little bit. But anyway.
I haven't – yeah, I can't speak to it that much. As I've said to you before, the TV's out of the house. I watched a movie on Amazon last night on my phone because I couldn't get to sleep, and I'll tell you about it later, but it was a good choice. But so I thought this was – here's what I thought was interesting about this. This is why I put it up. So HP is now HP – right, so HP Enterprise is they're trying to figure – my take on it is they're trying to figure out who they are when they grow up and what they want to be. But they got Christian Slater to do a new web series. But here's what I think is interesting, and this is the subheading. The first content work under the HP Studios banner – signals a larger overall shift to make security a pillar of HP's brand identity. That's a radical change for them. So they're connecting pop culture that I would argue has been widely supported and embraced by the security community.
Correct.
And they're doing it with a very big budget, very big focus way of doing it to say, hey, we're involved in security. So
you know, further evidence to back up your point, Michael, is that HP's printer division reached out to myself and others in the security community and to talk about what they're doing security-wise on printers. Now, unfortunately for HP, the conclusion of that activity, like the next couple of weeks, brought to light like this huge, huge printer vulnerability that's probably the worst ever that we've ever seen. So I don't want to say their efforts were wasted. I think it's good that HP's repositioning the security aspect of their business and making it more of a focus. If you've watched some of the ads with Christian Slater, though, they're okay. I mean, they're kind of lame.
I didn't. That's the reason. Look, the thing I looked at was this, because we're looking at startups, we're looking at security, right? And as we keep saying, there's the venture side, there's the idea side, there's the enterprise side. Of course, there's consumer side, but that's not really where most of us are going to spend our focus looking at this. And so I'm always trying to look at how these things are happening. So here we have an enterprise company looking at this. So if you're a startup today and you're going, I wonder if security matters to people, let me give you the short answer. Yes. Now, as you said before, Paul, does that mean that they know what you mean when you say security? No, probably not. So if you give them a list of features like, well, we have a firewall and antivirus, that doesn't matter. What they want to know is, do you understand that they have needs and are you willing and able to protect those needs accordingly? HP is spending a ton of money on it. A number of years ago, I watched Dell, or prior to whatever they're called today, but they were at SecureWorld. Paul, most of their day, they were talking about the word protect. Mm-hmm. It was in every single thing they did. They didn't say security.
Their internal conference, too, is HP Protect.
Okay. Well, not HP. This was Dell.
Oh, okay.
This was Dell doing this.
Dell stole it from HP, I guess.
Well, so what I took from it was to say, there you go. If a company worth billions of dollars does the research and they come out and they say, we're going to use the word protect, and that works across the spectrum, then you can fight it and cry about it, or you can try it, tell me how it works in your organization. So all I'm saying is I think there's stuff here to learn. If you're a startup, there's stuff to learn. If you're in the enterprise, there's stuff to learn. I want to get to the five biggest struggles. We don't have to go deep into this, but this one caught my attention, and I'm so glad I read it. So we talked about the sale of Invincia. I think we talked about the sale of Invincia last week.
We did.
So what's interesting is I did not know the backstory, and it turns out that the Washington Post covered the backstory of it. And here's how it worked. The guy was he was a program manager at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And he said, hey, I think there's a better thing to do here. And he said, you know, I wasn't really sure what I was able to do or how to make this work. And so – and it says here, this is why I shared it. Conventional wisdom states that entrepreneurs go to angel investors to get capital to create a product. And while this approach works well in markets with ample risk capital such as Silicon Valley, it wasn't – it's not usually successful in our region where capital is hard to find. I'm going to point out, I think that DC has more capital than a lot of other areas. But here's what he did. Mm-hmm. He joined George Mason University as a research professor. So that, by the way, doesn't this sound a little bit like what Frank was just talking about? Sought out federal research and development funding. By the way, we got a story about that coming up shortly. And then he used that. He advanced his vision. So basically, he didn't get an angel investor. He went and got a gig that gave him credibility and access and the space to go do all these things. And there you go. He was able to go build something and he turned it out and he turned around and sold it for a pretty impressive sum.
Nice.
The reason I wanted to point that out is that we've been pretty clear on our program that your exit strategy doesn't have to be an IPO, and that your mergers and acquisitions now, we're talking to enterprises that, you know, you've got two guys or two women in a garage sketching an idea on the back of a napkin. You're good. Come on
in. Yeah, but like your entrance strategy too can differ, and that's cool.
And that's all I was going to say is that there's no single path. And if you're creative enough and you got a good idea, you're good to go. Five biggest struggles. Man, I love this. Five biggest struggles as a first-time founder. Constantly doubting yourself. I'm in my 40s now. I kicked this when I hit 40. It took about a year. I'm over it. I was fortunate. I have a couple good friends, lifelong friends, that basically would listen to me and they would say, Michael, your instincts are good. I don't know why you're doubting yourself. You've got to stop. And they were in my head. I had 3 or 4 friends doing that to me pretty much almost on a daily basis. And a year later, I finally went, yeah, I'm okay. I've got good ideas. What the hell's wrong with me? But I read that and I went, oh man, I've lived through that. Number two, hiring the right people. I have made this mistake. It's costly. So I've learned. Trying to make everybody happy. Yeah, bad idea. Don't do it. Not knowing what type of leader you are. I didn't spend a lot of time on this one because, for obvious reasons, I spend time studying it. But in terms of being type of leaders, here's what I would say. There's a real big difference between being an individual contributor and being a leader, right? And so if people haven't heard me say this before, when we could do, Paul, we could do a whole program just on leadership, so we won't. It comes down to this. You lead people, you manage process, mm-hmm. You boss nobody. So when people say, I manage people. No. Mm-mm. Well, at least you shouldn't.
Right.
You manage the process. You can manage the outcomes. You can manage obstacles out of their way so you can lead them to whatever that better tomorrow looks like. But what I will say is a lot of people, being an individual contributor is very different than being a leader of a team of other people, depending on you to craft a vision and elevate them to where they need to get to be. So that, and then trusting your gut. How much do you trust your gut? When you're looking at the decisions, right, and you're a leader and you've got a couple teams around you, how often does your gut factor into it versus how much are you evidence-driven and more cool and methodical?
Yeah, there's I don't know if I could put a specific percentage or
give me,
whatever.
Give me a gut shot on this one. Use your gut. Answer it that way.
But there are times, and it's somewhat sporadic when it happens, that you're like, no matter how long I analyze the data and do analytical things, I got to make this decision with, based on my gut. And I hate, being a computer background, right? Like, I hate being in that position. Like, I want to write a program and analyze data to make decisions. And you're forced sometimes to trust your gut and hopefully you're right. I don't particularly like being in that situation. I think there's always data that you can collect to support that. But sometimes you got to go with your gut and I think you should trust it. It kind of ties into doubting yourself or not doubting yourself, right?
I've always loved the quote, good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment. Like, yes. And it's attributed to so many people. So we'll leave it at that high level. But man,
success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm.
Yeah, that was a Churchill quote, right?
Yep, so, absolutely.
All right, so here's the notes of interest. CB Insights did a report, the 2016 cybersecurity recap, deals hit a record high, but activity slows. And then they said, hey, you know what? We've got some new unicorns. Cylance got the $100 million Series D round in June. And then they gave us four. And it's what's kind of funny is, so 2015, four cybersecurity unicorns emerged. Illumio, I got to be honest, I haven't looked at them. Okta, I'm aware of who they are. Haven't looked at them.
I've looked at Okta,
Is it Tanium?
Tanium,
Okay. So I don't know. And then Zscaler. And what's funny is Zscaler's, I've known about them for so long that I actually didn't see them as a startup, but apparently they are and they're unicorns. So I'll dig deeper into them and we'll take a look at it. But I got to tell you, their stuff is expensive, so it's not anything I can subscribe to. But CB Insights puts out some really good quality stuff. And I'm going to start digging into that for some ideas. In fact, if I didn't send it to you yet, Paul, they've got a whole list of like startups worth looking at stuff. I think there's a lot.
I haven't looked at that list yet. So I will. Okay. Definitely.
All right. So Yahoo, it's funny because I'm the person who's railed against dragging all these companies out as often as we've dragged them out. But I'm also the first one to admit if there's something there, there's something there. So at the risk of sounding more negative than usual, I think our industry's been waiting for that watershed moment where you can say, see, told you. Well, so Yahoo, unfortunately, is playing that role for us. It turns out that they've botched their handling of a couple breaches, maybe kind of forgot to disclose them. Mm-hmm. And so that's getting them into a little bit of problems with the number of people. And so we talked about last week, that was like $250 million discount mm-hmm. on their acquisition. And I was quick to cautious and say, I'm not sure how much that is actually just due to the security breach versus opportunistic looking at leverage and a way to do it. Here's what I'm gonna come off that a little bit and say, Yeah, except for now the SEC is involved or whoever is investigating it. And then the news came out this week that Marissa Meyer lost her bonus and lost her stock award. And the board was very clear.
She's quoted publicly as saying that she gave it back to the hardworking people at Yahoo. Is that
The quote that I read was, and again, right? So the quote that I read, let me pull it up so I get it right. However, I am the CEO of the company, and since this incident happened during my tenure, I have agreed to forego my annual bonus and my annual equity grant this year and have expressed my desire that my bonus be redistributed to our company's hardworking employees who contributed so much to Yahoo's success in 2016.
Ah, okay.
So since we're going to be straight talking this for a second, board basically said, you screwed up. We're not firing you, or we can't fire you. They've got the double golden handcuffs. Whoever negotiated this at Yahoo was freaking brilliant. Nice. So she's stuck. They're stuck with her, however that works out. But you know, I've agreed to forego my annual bonus. That's like when you get fired and you're like, we've parted ways.
Yeah, okay.
She didn't have a choice on that. Okay. And all she's trying to do now is spin it and say, right. You know what, then? Instead of giving me the millions, why don't we distribute them out to everybody else and they can all get a cup of coffee on me type of thing. It's a smart way to handle an otherwise crappy situation, but that's all it was. So I just want to come back and say, you know, when not you, Paul, but collectively as a listener and then somebody engages with us, if I hear you quote Target, Home Depot, Sony Pictures or something else, I go, see, that's an example right there. No, it's not. Those are very clear, almost always cover.
I have a different example, Michael.
What's your example?
Supermicro shipped servers to Apple. It wasn't disclosed how many or what the amount was. Apple actually discovered internally that the firmware on those servers was infected with some kind of malware, shipped them back, and reportedly severed ties with Supermicro, severed their agreement with them.
That sounds good. And even if that's folklore, kick-ass story to use, right? Like,
Apple's very cagey about what details they release.
Which I think is great.
A lot of the details came from Supermicro that said, yeah, this is what happened, and Apple severed their agreement with us. It's really not in Supermicro's best interest to say, like, one of our largest customers just severed business ties with us, but they did. In full disclosure, Apple is, of course...
There were probably whispers, right? Because if you're in that community, we always know there's a small group of people that whisper, so they had to get in front of it. But you know what? Here's what I love about that. Although it sounds negative, that's a positive story. You're not saying somebody screwed up security and they got fired and they got paid all this money and so you all got to pay attention to it. It went the other way around and somebody said, hey, we did our diligence. It wasn't right. We shipped it back. We're done. We can't trust you. Right. Yeah, that's what we're seeing happening. Now
also on the positive side, props to Apple for discovering it before it got too entrenched in their network. I think the negative side is I would have liked to seen more information from Apple and Supermicro about the details of the attack so that the rest of the world can go check their servers to make sure that we don't have the same vulnerability in the interest of kind of open source disclosure.
That's a fair point. Yeah, and I think it's something we can keep looking at. Here's the point I want to make in this one because I think it's relevant for startups. So let me just do this, right? If you're going to use an example like this, please be careful when you use the example. Mm. This is not the largesse of, let me prove it. This is a one-time thing so far, but I think it's fairly credible that you can use this. Here's what matters. The board got involved. The board is paying attention. Right. The board, because keep in mind, if you're on a board, if you're on a public board, you have a fiduciary responsibility. As a director, you're liable. So if the SEC is coming in, that board is liable. And they do not like that pressure.
Well, and so I think a segue into the Falconry story that you had in here where they got a $5.3 million in equity and they predict operating and performance conditions. We saw recently this past week that S3 had some issues.
Yeah.
We saw the Cloudflare vulnerability. So companies that are predicting operating and performance conditions in the cloud are excited. Right. But back to your point, Michael, be careful how you use those examples. If you're a startup that's doing this, if you're could help an organization that has a big cloud deployment and suffered because of the S3 outage or the Cloudflare syntax error or whatever it was that leaked memory, just be careful how you structure your story. You don't want to be accused, especially in security. You don't want to be accused of spreading FUD. So
look, I tell you what, if I get a pitch and it's like S3 went down, we could have prevented it. Delete. I don't really care. Yep. But if somebody reaches out to me and they go, hey, the thing that happens at S3 happens at organizations all over the place. And you know what? Because I'm also tired of blaming people. I'm clear on that. People know how I feel. I don't hide my opinions on that. But if somebody comes out and they said, look, these things happen. And we help get ahead of that. We help. Oh, you know what? I'm willing to interest because you're going to start with, hey, we still need people. It works out. Here's why I picked up Falconry. Paul, you turned me on to Owler, and I love it. And if you're out there and you're following stuff and you think there's things we should take a look at, it's great. So they focus on unplanned downtime. So what's interesting is they're not what I would call a pure play security product. But I was just interested in enough to go, let me go take a look at what they do. And if you go hover over their solutions, they have pattern recognition for IoT. They have pattern recognition for Splunk. We talk about that a lot in security. We have pattern recognition for IT operations, and they help you handle unplanned downtime. I went, oh, those are security companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, what have we talked about with our guests recently? The more you can use data and intelligence to get where you need to be, the better off. Absolutely. All right, Light Cyber. So Palo Alto is lightening up with Light Cyber, $105 million. So what I looked at, so they raised a total of $31.5 million, and I've got to get better now. Their last round was $20 million. I do not know what the valuation on that was. Mm-hmm. It feels like this is probably, based on what we started to see with other deals, this is about in line. Now, if you're listening and you're throwing something at your computer screen or your radio right now saying, no, it's wrong, good, correct us. Trust me. I will learn this a lot better.
John Strand had, I think, the best take on this story when we covered it. We also covered this on Enterprise Security Weekly. Basically, John said, look, Cisco is catching up in the security department. And I think one of the things John didn't mention was Cisco had that big layoff that we covered. And they're refocusing, much like HP, that you pointed out, Michael, on security. And I think if you follow Palo Alto stock, like Palo Alto's kind of like shitting a brick and going, uh-oh, we better go acquire a security company. And like Cyber, from what I've heard, makes a decent product. If you have experience with that, or, you know, let us know. We love feedback from our listeners.
Well, and it fits from the Palo Alto side, right? So I'm looking at performance. I'm looking at machine learning.
Light Cyber is
network. I was reading the wrong line.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Light Cyber is actually a direct competitor to Offensive Countermeasures, the startup that John and I have. They're probably the closest one in terms of network behavior analysis for security threats. So I think that falls in line with Palo Alto's product.
That's actually a little bit validating for you then. So if
that's exactly what I said to John. I'm like, John, this is a good thing for us, right? Like we're in the right space.
That's a great thing for you because, I did a thought process the other day, and then this all ties into it. And I started looking at it. So I told you. I started trying to think about my focus more and more is working with those startups that are stuck, right? And because I love what we do, and there's a lot of reasons that it all works. And if people are interested, I'm happy to talk about it. But here's the thing that's interesting then. You start looking at this and you go, okay, well, how many unicorns are there in security? And there's like a dozen or two dozen. I couldn't list them all, so I need to do a better job there. But what's interesting is, to your point, Palo Alto's got to be looking at this going, how's that FireEye stock working out right now? You know, what did we see with CrowdStrike? Their public spat with NSS is going to be interesting, but I don't think it went well for them. And most of the headlines I'm reading say it didn't go well for them. You know, and Silence jumped into the fray. I'm going to be curious to see how this goes for them. And, you know, and the rest of it is you look at a lot of these high-flying technologies. Are they sexy? Awesome. Yeah, they're great. And, you know, Jack Daniel's not here, so we can't do our regular chip and pin discussion. But, quell surprise at all the people saying, oh, well, fraud's, up and on the increase. Right. Chip and pin is sexy, but it didn't solve the problems we're trying to solve. So I think that looking at acquisitions like this, let's see how they do with the integration of it. Let's see how they use it.
Right.
Let's see what that looks like. This could be brilliant or this could be not so brilliant. Bastille. So this is the one I thought was interesting. And I've heard the name. I've not looked at it. I'm really interested now. So I thought it was interesting because I see the headline comes across and it says Bastille just raised 196.8K. And I'm like, that's an oddly specific number, and it's under a million. Wait, what?
Yeah. Let me go take a look at this. After I read this, there actually are a lot of grants available that we've covered on the show for IoT security. I don't think the one that I covered last year was a DHS grant. Might have been a different grant, but the government is issuing money for IoT security, which is, I think, interesting and a good thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting too. I told you I was at a startup event, I don't know, last week, maybe it was 2 weeks ago. My brain is not working well these days. And I was talking about innovation in cybersecurity and a bunch of big brain people around. Somebody came to me afterwards and they said, you know what I'd love to see? And I didn't have permission to use his name, but what he said is, he understands my desire to not have to regulate or over-regulate everything. He said, why can't the government then go create a common standard and go create a common platform and just make it free and give it to everybody and say, here, build on this. And then here I am a week later saying, oh, well, we have a DHS grant that said, go take a look at what we know and where there's problems and what we need to do to fix it. Oh, well, maybe we're on the right path. So I thought that was interesting. And the other thing I was going to point out is they have like $13 to $15 million in funding already. So you can get grants. So what we've covered so far today, you can get a grant to get started. You can work at a university and get a grant to get started. You can get angel funding. You can bootstrap. You can productize a service. Oh, by the way, you can also then, when you're funded already, still apply for grants to solve problems that get your name in the press, that give you some money to go focus on something that probably helps you and a lot of other people too. So gosh, there's just a ton of stuff happening, and I think it's all good and exciting.
I agree. Startup journey, Michael.
It's been a great week, man. I have been pivoting, and I'm done. Like I, you know, you get to that point where you have the conversation enough, and you're like, oh, that sounds good. That sounds good to me. But you're listening to people get excited and start to push faster, and you're like, all right, cool. I'm going to be rebuilding the website. The hope is as quick as this weekend, I'm going to streamline it. I've been on this cognitive load kick. I looked at my own website and I went, whoa. I held off on this for the longest time. Simple thing. Would it be better for me to go build the deck and have conversations and figure out what I'm doing and sell deals? Or would it be better for me to go work on a website? And up until now, the answer has been refine your pitch, build your deck, deliver services. The last 2 weeks, I've gotten a lot of, that's not what your website says. Well, this is great. I love this. But how come that's not what your website says? Okay. We're at the point now where it's time to do a little pivot. And I'm a little stressed because I really don't want to work this weekend, but we're going to get that done. I've also narrowed my addressable market.
And I hate working on websites.
Yeah, no, right? Like if you really make me snappy, websites, and let me go play with CRM systems, but I'm not going there today. The other thing I've learned, we'll talk more about this, and we're going to start asking our guests about this. It's addressable market. So like if we look at Straight Talk, and what I'm able to do now is I can go in and I can help you both diagnose why your project is stuck. Notice I'm not focusing on people. Yes, you can interpret to people. Why is your project stuck and how do you get it unstuck before it's too late? And then, of course, how do you avoid getting stuck again? Okay, well, out of the Fortune 5000, I think it's probably safe to say there's like, what, 10, 12 stuck projects at each of those companies? Cool. That's not my addressable market. No way. I can't go after that. If you break it down and just go, well, let's just go security projects. It's still too big. So what I'm starting to take a look at, and if you're listening, I would love your feedback on where to focus. I'm thinking identity is a play. I'm looking at what I'm calling this one risk model. I'm hearing a lot of people talk about, you know, you can't have enterprise risk, which is separate from your security risk, which is separate from your insurance risk, which we've got to figure out how to, I'm looking at things where we've got to bring different groups of people together to solve those problems. And then as I'm looking at, trying to define the problem set, what I'm realizing is that then there's a number of startups that are in that post Series A, struggling to get to Series B, they're stuck because they've got all the same types of issues internally that I can fix and help them get traction externally to connect them to the enterprises that want to solve the exact same problems. And whoa, I think I've figured out where I can go sit comfortably and really make a difference in this industry and, you know, pay the bills. So I'm pretty jazzed.
Nice.
But I'll send you the list. I'd love your feedback on it at some point because I've
absolutely.
Dude, my head is going sideways. How about you guys? Good?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I was saying before about kind of honing some of your pitch in sales decks and having some different materials there, I think is interesting. You know what's kind of funny? Have you ever seen the guy that's obviously some kind of like professional trainer or speaker, and he draws the XY axis, and it's the hot and the crazy scale?
Yeah.
You ever see that? Like that's all. Like now, leadership and communication, right? You must have watched that and been like, "Wow, like that." I mean, it's a very funny, tongue-in-cheek topic, obviously. Yeah. Not very politically correct, although I did hear they did it in the opposite order, like, you know, the guy won for women. But I thought the way that was communicated was really powerful. And I'm kind of like using those visual aids. I talked about how John had a great visual aid for some of the technology, and I think we're kind of honing our messaging to be like that, and that's one of the goals.
I was just saying, keep doing it. That's awesome.
Yeah, and you know, new interface is coming up. Working on the open source one, but also latest iteration of the web interface is being reviewed right now. So that's exciting as well.
That's awesome. That's really cool. No, and you're right. Like with me, I've found now that, and one of the things I always tell people about Straight Talk is it's not about being right; it's about getting to the right place. I love the feedback I get from people, and I take notes. And there's a lot of times now I find, Paul, the more that I single task, the less I can multitask. So I'm like, hold on a second. I'm going to be quiet. I'm writing that down. And right. I jot down these ideas, but it takes time. I'm like, if I think about ways I explain stuff just even 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago versus now, now is so much better. But I'm working on this every single day. Mm-hmm. I'm stable for a while. And I'm going to go get everything updated, and then I promise you it'll change again. So, and we'll be back next week. We got more exciting guests, and we're going to keep legitimizing security in the startup community and a startup mindset in the security community.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for watching this edition of Startup Security Weekly. We'll see everyone next week.